Hello, everyone, and welcome into debate afternoon night is what
early,
it is.
Early
debate
night.
Debate early night. New time this week. This isn't going to be the time we sit at, but we had to go a little early this week. We had some other obligations, but we are going to try to move it a little bit earlier. I think it's going to go better. I'll have more energy. I know that much. You won't have to worry about me falling asleep.
Do we do like a off hour time, like the 6:30 time, or do we just like do like a 6 or 7?
I like 6 Eastern.
6?
I like even times first off, but I also I think 6 because we try to go about 2 hours. I think 6 to 8 range.
Yeah.
I think that's our sweet spot. I think that's our money time.
We'll try that maybe next week then.
My dad tuned in last week was like the first time he like watched and he tuned in late, which is when I was like falling off and he thought it was the funniest thing because I just couldn't keep my eyes open. I was just yawning like crazy.
We were getting. Well, also, too, if, like, Tuesday's a long day for us, and, like, 8 to 10, we're just like,
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think all in all, it'll be a better show. And moving forward, you're actually going to be playing the show out. So, that's going to be kind of exciting for me because I'm coming in and not having any idea what we're going to talk about.
Well, it's also exciting for our audience because we don't have to worry about grip locked and debate night talking about the same thing because I plan both. So, like, this week, for instance, there is no overlap at all. Now, there might be something where I'm like, oh, this was a great topic we talked about on debate night. Trevor, what's your opinion on it?
Mm-hmm.
But it's different than like we talk about the All-Star event here. Mm-hmm. And then tomorrow I talk about the All-Star event. And it's like, oh, I just heard Hunter talk about this 12 hours ago.
Yeah. And if there is anything that we don't talk about and it's like I want to bring to attention, then it's kind of getting probably a different perspective on that topic versus kind of nailing some of the other stuff. But before we jump into anything, I have a story to tell you guys.
Heck
so
yeah.
I was down in Florida and the Tampa area and a lot of really cool courses in Tampa. There's actually a really cool course in Lakeland, which is about a 30-minute drive east of Tampa. And then if you go over the water, the bridge over in Clearwater, that's where like Cliff Stevens is, which is like the Climo course and all that. And there's a lot of cool courses over there. So we're at Cliff Stevens. I think this is my second day. And we're trying to like nail out two or three courses every day. And so second day, we're at Cliff Stevens and I'm playing with my buddy Chris, who I played Ultimate Frisbee with at the University of Florida. And he has kind of found a group of guys that we all kind of used to play against because they all used to go to either USF or UCF, so either in the Tampa area or Orlando. And they all played Ultimate. And then kind of after college, for the most part, everyone kind of melds together in the club scene or in the pro scene. So he's played with them Ultimate Frisbee-wise as an opponent and as a teammate. But a lot of guys are starting to switch over, which you don't really see it here because there's the Ultimate scene in Lynchburg isn't that massive.
Yeah.
And I didn't really see it even in Dallas because, again, like Dallas doesn't really have a big university. They have SMU and they have UNT. But those aren't big Ultimate Frisbee. UNT's a little bit, but they're kind of further out. I didn't really see that many like Ultimate Frisbee people transferring over. But in Tampa, like I got to see firsthand, when we showed up, there was a group of like 7 guys that were playing together, all Ultimate Frisbee people that are now playing disc golf. And I think it's one of those things too, an interesting point is in Ultimate Frisbee, a lot of times, if you're not one of the best throwers, 3 or 4 guys, you don't throw the disc. So you go play a sport for a long, long time where you don't actually ever get to throw the disc. And now in disc golf, you're throwing the disc every single time. So I think for some people, it's a cool transition that way. But the funny story is we're on the tee pad and this guy comes up and he's like, hey, do you have a Sharpie? And I was like, oh, I don't have one. But one of the buddies I was with was like, oh, I have a Sharpie. So he hands me a Roach, very used. Okay, it wasn't like a brand new Roach. It's one of the Brody Dark Horse Roaches. Hands it to me, and I sign it. I'm like, here you go, man. Hope you have a good day. Have a good round, whatever. And I go because I'm about to tee off. So I go tee my shot off, and all the other guy, I think someone says, "What the heck?" And I turn, and the dude just wings the disc as hard as he can in the middle of the lake, and then like pulls out his cell phone. Because I guess he was recording the whole interaction, pulls out his cell phone, is like, and like, I don't know if he used F word or whatever, but he obviously did something in the sense of like, screw you, Brody, you suck kind of thing, and just walks off. And unfortunately, the guy was deaf. So like, I didn't realize he was deaf until after the fact, but I tried to be like, hey, like, is everything okay? Like, what's going on? To try to figure out what it was that I have done to someone that I've never talked to, never met, for them to have this kind of interaction with me. But he was deaf, so he didn't hear me as he was walking off. And the other guys were just like, what the heck just happened? I was like, I've had interactions, like weird interactions before. That was probably one of the top 10.
That's amazing.
Because again, it's like, either, so the, okay, who knows what I said or did or whatever to make him actually pissed off at me. But the weirdest thing is, how did he get that disc? So he either had that disc in his bag,
was a fan of you,
and used it,
yeah,
because it was a very used disc, or he somehow convinced one of his friends that had, like, how did he get that? Or
maybe he bought it
or he bought it used for the potential of potentially meeting me down the road, and has just been thinking, I don't know. Regardless, he also ran. We were way out of his way, because when he got to us, he was out of breath. So like, he ran to get to us.
Wild.
Either way,
that's amazing.
I hope I see the video.
That's a lot of effort to go to.
I was just thinking, like,
if you guys see the video, because I'm sure it got posted probably in some sort of Facebook page or something, please tweet me the video, because I'm just curious as to the throw. I'm like, did he throw it well? Did he launch? Did it actually make it into the lake? Because it was pretty far. The lake was pretty far away.
Dang. But we gotta put that as like a punishment for if we go to a big tournament.
You
like
have Trevor to ask someone for their autograph and then chuck it into the lake afterwards.
Like USDGC, we like run up to someone on hole five when they're like practice, like during a practice round, or like somewhere it's acceptable to ask for a signature. And like, whoever lost the challenge is be like, oh dude, I don't even know what pro, Nico, dude, such a huge fan, please can have your signature. And just have them sign it and then just rip it into the middle of the lake. And just like, and that's your punishment. You just have to accept whatever comes next.
Yikes.
Might not be the best one.
I was going to say, did you see the Nico clip that's going around right now on Twitter?
I haven't, no.
Where he's like he's doing a standstill straddle putt, and he makes the putt, and I think Barry Schultz was on the card. This is a while ago. And Barry Schultz calls on the footfall. Have you seen that clip?
I've seen the clip from the coverage back in the day.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he calls, for the listeners, he calls footfall, and Nico doesn't move his feet.
Yeah.
He's like, there's a footfall. And then someone else on the card comes up and's like, seconds it. And he's just like staring at his feet, like, and I guess it's because they're saying his left foot was
one of the
closer,
feet was in front of the other. Yeah.
This is what he's saying. So he goes, walks, picks up the disc, walks back, resets, and I guess like takes a half step or whatever further back. So it's definitely not even close. Jams the putt again. This is like a 35 footer, and it's for the tie for lead. Jams the putt again. It was like, how was that? And as he's walking up,
I think that was back in the day.
I was like, yes,
that was back in the, it's a warning first. So like, that means, I think, I could be wrong,
he just had a re-putt because it was seconded. So I guess there was no penalty.
I think
stroke.
I don't know,
what is the rule now?
The rule used to be weird. Now you can get a penalty immediately.
So your putt counts, but you get a penalty stroke?
I believe
second?
So. I believe so. Mm. What it used to be, because I remember one of the calls that like made it change was, I want to say it was USDGC. It was either Eric Oakley was the one who made the footfall call, but it was either Ricky or Paul that threw it, and they footfaulted, but their shot went OB.
Oh, and their second shot was better.
And so Eric it made the right call of it being a footfault, but he made the call kind of after the shot was clearly in the water. He's like, hey, dude, that was a footfault. And it got seconded or whatever happened. And
it helped them.
Yeah. And then they threw the second shot and parked it. And it wasn't a stroke penalty. I think back, it might not need to be seconded. Maybe that's what it was. I think now that it has to be seconded, you get the stroke.
Okay.
So maybe back then it didn't need to be seconded. But that was one of the rules that like it was forced to change, because there was situations where you could help out a player of like, oh, dude, you kicked your disc a little bit. Just rethrow if a shot had landed OB or something like that. And then you rethrow and it's like, now I've got a gauge of the wind and stuff like that.
You can basically like almost help someone.
So. Yeah.
But let us know in the comments, if you guys are listening live, how the show is. How do you like the show? Because Hunter, this is Hunter's show. He's rolling with it.
I haven't even got to any of my topics yet.
I know. But
don't judge me yet.
No, but like at the end of the show, let us know, because if it sucks, it's because of Hunter.
Yeah, just know that. That's fair. That's fair. But it's not going to suck. We're going to start off with Super Bowl predictions. That's the first thing I have on my list.
Silas, who's in the Super Bowl?
Yeah, Silas.
Silas,
chance number two.
Who's in the Super Bowl?
That's a great question.
Oh, no. You got to know this time. You already messed up once. You got this.
It's the
two teams.
Yeah, one's a cat. I know that. One's a cat. And one's kind of like a cat, but nope, kind of like a goat.
Okay, one's the Rams.
Yeah.
Because Matthew Stafford, I remember Matthew Stafford is the quarterback.
Now, the other one's a big cat. Big, big cat.
See, I feel like I said the Bengals the other time, and I feel like I got it wrong, but I think it's the Bengals still.
Yeah.
I'm going with the Bengals.
You got it this time. Oh, this time you're actually right. Wait, last time what you got wrong was you said the 49ers, I think. You had the Bengals right. You said the other team wrong.
There was a lot of people that thought we also had no idea what we were talking
about. Yeah, which that was hilarious. We just committed to the joke. And then I saw several comments. They're like, guys, you realize it? And then they're like, oh, never mind. I kept watching. I understand now. But Super Bowl predictions, who's winning? Who do you have?
I'm going with the Rams.
Okay.
I want the Rams to win.
You want
the Rams
to win. I
feel like I've never seen them in the Super Bowl. I don't know if that's true.
Well, you definitely have never seen the Bengals in the Super Bowl.
Oh. Well, I'm going with the Rams.
That's fine. I want the Bengals. I want Joe Burrow to win.
Yeah, I definitely think the Bengals would be a cooler story than the Rams. However, it is also would be impressive because the Rams kind of did like the build your team this year, which normally doesn't work, but it's working for them. So it'll be kind of crazy to see Stafford come in, OBJ, Von Miller, all these guys that kind of just came in. But Kelsey last night, she said Bengals money line. So we're all in Bengals money line.
Boom.
And we'll see what happens.
I'm liking the Bengals. I really want Joe Burrow to win.
I want them to win so bad because I want to continue to bet.
I saw,
And if they lose, then I have no money in my account. And I told Kelsey I won't reload it, but
yikes.
I saw a post where I believe the stat was Joe Burrow is the youngest quarterbacks who were taken first overall in the draft.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Burrow is the youngest of them to make it to the Super Bowl.
That's not surprising.
And then Matt Stafford's the oldest of them to make it to his first Super Bowl. So they both were drafted first. Matt Stafford is the longest it's taken for someone to get to a Super Bowl, and Joe Burrow is the shortest.
Of the people who have actually
made the Super Bowl? Of the people who have actually
made the Super Bowl. Yeah.
Is this his first Super Bowl?
Both of them. They're both their first. Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And he's been in the league for a while,
yeah, but he's been
in
the Lions, and they've just been trash.
So they've just had him and Calvin Johnson. They had Calvin Johnson.
They were always having a decent offense, but
couldn't get it all together.
But we're gonna do a parlay. We have to do a parlay. Obviously, it's got to be Bengals oriented. So I think we go. I haven't looked at the lines yet, but I think we go Ja'Marr Chase over whatever his receiving yards is. Joe Burrow over whatever his passing yards is, and then I think we go Bengals score over.
So that way, over the Bengals.
That way,
I think,
because we want the Bengals to win, so we gotta be rooting for good things to happen for the Bengals.
I've told Trevor, because Trevor said that it's a requirement for the Super Bowl party, you have to put a bet down. That's not actually true, but I was like, you know what?
We should do that.
I was like, I don't want to force someone to bet if they don't want to bet. I was like, I'm willing to do it. So I'm thinking I'm just gonna put like 10 bucks in on a crazy parlay and just. That way, like, if it starts, and they're all going to be ones that, like, they could all hit in the fourth quarter. So that way, I'm not
going
to go,
alive.
Like, a first touchdown, miss it, and you're
keeps the spirits up.
But I think it's definitely going to include Bengals money line. I'm going to take the game over, just because it's fun to root for points. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the over set at for the game, but that way you're rooting for both teams to score. So that way it's just fun.
It might honestly be not terribly high, because a lot of people think the Rams' defensive line is just going to suffocate the Bengals' offense. Yeah.
And then I'm going to just look at, I'll probably take Burrow passing yards. I might take Stafford passing yards. I'm going all overs. I'm hammering the over.
Just so
screw
that
the
way
under.
You can't lose.
That way I'm always rooting for something. I don't want to be like, okay, well, stop passing. Let's calm down here.
Yeah.
But I'll have to look at the lines, because I do want it to be a realistic one.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to be crazy, but realistic. But I would also love for my 10 bucks to go in and walk away with like a new set of golf clubs or something.
Yeah, I'm going to be plus 1,000 or more for my parlay.
Jeez.
That's what I'm looking
for. I didn't even know what a parlay was until today when Trevor explained it.
Dude, betting's wild, man.
That's crazy.
Yeah. He was saying that you can do like 10 bucks and like get like 10,000 bucks.
Well, yeah, but it has to it has to all hit.
Yeah,
but
that's just, also, it just seems so wild.
I mean, yeah, it's I didn't know that.
I look at it as I'm paying $10. I'm not gambling $10. I'm paying $10 to be more invested in the game.
To be more
entertained. It's how I look at it. Well, I look at it as I'm paying 10 bucks to be more entertained by the game.
If you're not gambling to try to, like, if you're not gambling for a job, that is the best way. Like, when you go to Vegas or wherever where you're actually playing blackjack, whatever it may be doing, that's always the best mindset of, like, I'm going to sit down and play blackjack for an hour and I'm paying $100 to be in, like, to have entertainment.
Yeah, I look at it as I'm paying, not I'm hoping to win.
Yeah, if you go the other route and it's not your job, you just feel terrible and you end up not having fun.
Yeah. Well, you also, like, then if I lose the 10 bucks, I'm like, well, you know, if I bet five this week, I might be able to get that 10 back. And then next thing you know, I'm listing my house for sale.
Exactly.
All right. I did go on Twitter because there wasn't a lot that happened this past week. Before I say anything about Twitter, I do want to, in case people haven't heard, Johnny McRae suffered a pretty major heart attack during this past week. I believe it was actually a disc golf tournament. I believe he's been moved out of the ICU. I think that was the last update I saw, or he was about to be on the last update I saw. But main thing I want to talk about here is, if you know Johnny McRae, legend of the sport, all of that, but obviously he had to be ventilated, stuff like this. Hospital bills are very high. I've seen several different companies posting discs and stuff like that that you can buy with 100% of proceeds going there. I know Dynamic Disc has some. I believe I just saw where Latitude posted some. EV7 had posted some signed putters, stuff like that. So, you know, if you
Does he have a GoFundMe going right
now? I don't think they have a GoFundMe, but if you go to his Facebook page, and I believe it's posted on his Instagram, they have the PayPal and Venmo for them directly.
Okay.
His wife has been running his Instagram and his Facebook, keeping people updated. So if you're in a position that you can give, or maybe if you want to pick up a Johnny McRae signature disc right now or something along those lines, please do so and look through all the different avenues that you can do that. Like I said, there's several through Trilogy, EV7, and then on his Facebook page and Instagram, you can find A, updates, but B, different ways to give directly. I think they didn't want to do GoFundMe because there is like a percentage taken out.
Oh,
so they figured PayPal and stuff, you can go direct them. So now let's get into Twitter. Since nothing really happened topic-wise this past week, I just put a tweet out because I was like, this could be fun. And I wanted to hear people's most debatable topics.
Okay.
I got like 80-some replies. I didn't read through every single one, but I read through enough. I picked out ones, some of them that we haven't talked about before that I'm curious, and other ones that we might disagree on so that debate night can actually have some debates maybe. Regardless, I figured these are some great topics. So, number one I saw, and this was from several different people, was that golf course hybrids, so disc golf on golf course, needs to not exist on the pro level, and courses like Northwoods Black should be the future of professional disc golf. So essentially, we need to step away from going towards golf course open style courses, and we need to step into the woods. Now, in my head, there's pros and cons to this. Pro, it's a lot easier to make disc golf difficult, more challenging, and more entertaining to a certain degree to the viewer behind the camera when you're in the woods. That is true. Major con: A, cell signal in the woods when we're trying to live stream. B, this one's even bigger, is as the sport grows, you can't fit galleries in the woods. At least not the current woods we have. So I wanted to hear your take too as a player. What do you think is like a good balance, or is there even like a course out there you're like, this course is the ideal way of like, it challenges us, but it also has good ways for galleries to be there and such and such?
Yeah, so I think one of the reasons why the Pro Tour goes to golf courses right now is because everything is set up already amenity-wise for everything. Like you talked about, they normally have Ethernet, like plug-in internet to where you can have no problem with cell service. And then they'll have a clubhouse with amenities, bathrooms, parking, all that stuff. So it makes it a lot easier than potentially some of these courses that are just like in a park that might just have a bathroom where it has like one stall for both men and women. The other thing is exactly what you talked about is if you go into the woods, okay, so say now you have like a private, or sorry, a public course, because I believe Northwoods Black is in a park.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's not privately owned.
Mm-mm.
So you go into a course like that, you're going to be very limited already with like what you could potentially do to set up that course for spectators to get into the woods. Because I think one of the things that would be really, really cool to see is you only need probably 10 yards to 15 yards of woods on the sideline, like on the outside of the fairway, right? To really make a hole a wooded hole. And then you could potentially have OB outside of that 10 to 15 yards. And then you basically can have spectators now there. And they can almost, if you build up, again, this is something that is going to cost a lot of money and something that will only really probably happen on private lands. But if you wanted a purely wooded course, that's probably the only way that you could do it is where you actually kind of cut out paths
mm-hmm.
for spectators that are higher up standing, looking in through 10 yards of woods and seeing the players, because you can't have spectators down the fairway.
Yeah.
You just can't do it. The other thing is, could there be potential of having courses that the woods aspect is still there in the sense of like you have to have hit gaps and lines, but you don't necessarily have all the scrambling in the woods. So you kind of clear out all the stuff outside of the fairway, but you still have in the fairway, you still have all those trees and stuff that you have to hit gaps. I personally think too, like watching a disc fly through the woods is definitely more appealing than watching a disc fly just out down a fairway in golf on a golf course. But you bring up all the points of like how, like if you have 5,000 people, how do you get them into a course, even like Waco? How do you get 5,000 people spread out to where, you know, I don't know.
Well, I think that what you said about having, because I've played golf course hybrids in this area where there are some woods to deal with. And so you're either throwing out of the woods
into
the open, or you're throwing into the woods mm-hmm. to where you do have to hit lines and such. Or there's some where they have like rows of pine trees to where the trees are really spread out to where if there was a gallery, it would fit, but you still have to hit gaps and throw a tunnel shot, whatever. Those scenarios work, but the thing that makes woods disc golf so special to me is the scrambling.
Yeah.
Because I think that's something where it's like a natural OB in a sense, to where if you get into the woods, you have a chance for the hero shot that can be exciting, of like a crazy backhand Anheuser back to the fairway that flattens out and gets you to the basket, or like some high forehand, whatever. But in the scenario of you just have trees defining the fairway, but we're still in the open, you kick to the right, ears in the open. Yeah, you missed the line, so now you might have to throw through two or three trees to get back to the basket, but it's not like you're having some insane scramble shot. But again, the insane scramble shots happen where the spectators need to be standing, essentially. And so that's the only thing that keeps me from saying, like, yeah, I agree with you. Woods disc golf is the future. Because woods disc golf, scoring-wise, I love score separation. I think it really challenges pros, and it's a lot easier to challenge those pros without just making crazy long and crazy tight OBs. And it is more fun viewership wise to watch a disc have to be shaped through lines versus in the open. If you miss your line, I as a spectator have no idea you missed your line, because mm-hmm. like unless you go OB, there's no way for me to be like, oh my word, that was such an awful shot. In the woods, I have a visual factor of like, oh, you didn't turn that nearly enough. That's going straight into the woods. And it makes the disc golf way more impressive.
So I think tee shots in the woods, you can see, like the cameras can get in good places to where you can see the disc, a good shot, and then you can see when a disc hits a tree and shoots off. I do, though, think sometimes it's difficult to really grasp how good a shot is coming out of the woods.
Correct.
Because a lot of times you get the camera from the fairway shooting into the woods with a player, and then you just kind of get the side profile of it coming out, and you don't really get to see the gap and all that stuff. So I think sometimes when you have played the course, especially when you've played the course and you know, like, oh man, these woods are tough when you get in there, then you have a little bit more appreciation for when shots come out and they're effective. But I think the filming sometimes in the woods, even for live or even for post, I think sometimes you lose just how crazy of a shot was, or you lose just the flight of the scrambling because of the profile nature of like side by side filming. And then, you know, when you cut to the catch cam, it's kind of late in the flight and you don't really get to see. So that's where like there's pros and cons to it, of where if it's like super, super heavily wooded, to where the interesting thing is like, could you make it to where some spots are very wooded? You keep some spots very, very wooded and you open up other spots. I don't know what that would look like. And obviously no course has really done anything like that before. But it'd be interesting. And you could also theoretically have to where, like you said, of where you could have like the big trees and stuff down the fairway where you have to hit gaps. And then if you go off of that, then there's the all the woods and brush and stuff that you kind of just let go.
I think that the answer of the future is there's going to be a weird transition period where we do have to, I think we're kind of in it, where we do have to have golf courses, open courses stand in while the private courses, while disc golf gets big enough that the private courses can make it, because there are courses like MVP that has done a decent enough job that they can have pretty large galleries while still have a wooded wooded feeling. Now, the gallery can't watch every hole, but that's okay. But you're able to watch a lot of it, have a wooded feel and stuff like that. You also have, I think, I haven't seen the full course of Eagles Crossing, but private courses, I think, have a lot more potential to be that like open woods hybrid, because you can pick and choose a lot more when you have basically an entire park and you're like, okay, so we can play,
what do we want to do with it?
From, yeah, out of the woods into the woods. So the last 300 feet are going into the woods, but the gallery can easily stand in the open and watch players still scramble and stuff, give you the features of wooded golf without there. And the next one, the first 300 feet. So again, the gallery can be lining the gap coming out of the woods and the gallery doesn't have to go cram into the woods. I think that personally is the longer term future. It's just disc golf needs to grow enough that it can support those private courses, so that people are willing to pour whatever, I think it's like $1.some million allegedly into this Eagles Crossing course. People are willing to pour that much in because they know, hey, over 5 years, I'm be able to get that much back out.
Because when I just to kind of put a bow on it, when I think of like Northwood Black, with which was the example used, they have some really cool par four and par fives to play. But when you stretch out the holes that far, what you were suggesting is like you could have either the gallery behind and watch from, you know, watch them throw down and play the par three, or you could sometimes have the gallery behind the basket and watch the players throw and play the par three. It gets tricky when it's a par four or par five.
Well, I'm almost saying like the par four, it starts in the open, big drive, and then the approach shot lasts 100 feet.
That
the
works too. What I'm saying is like the opposite of like if it was all wooded par four, or all wooded par five, the only thing you can do is have the gallery pushed behind the players. And then it just gets a real kind of weird feel of it.
Fairway either has to be so wide that it's not really a wooded hole, or you just can't have a big gallery. Correct. That's the biggest issue, I think. This one's from Colin Fitchett. I believe that's how you say his name. And this one is very interesting to me because it's something that I hadn't considered until Trevor said it on Grip Lock like 2 weeks ago, which is the future of disc golf lies outside of the USA. Because that's something that we haven't really thought of. We always talk about like the European markets boom and European market this, that, the other. European Open's always a good gauge of like that tournament is always just massive. What if disc golf realistically is a sport like soccer or like cricket or something, where it just becomes like the sport in a Finland or in a country like that, and the best players and the best tour and all of that is European, and the U.S. it is more or less like it happens, but it's kind of like side tours. Like, what if a European? I guess what I'm saying is like, what if a European tour started up and had more money. Because like it might be more realistic for them to get Nike on board than a U.S. tour. And then it's like if you're Paul, Ricky, yourself, you're sitting here and you're like, we can play the Pro Tour. But this European tour is, you know, there you could win $100,000 week in and week out over there or $10,000 week in and week out over here. That's something that's very interesting. I think a very real possibility.
Yeah, the money and exposure are going to be the two things that draw players to tournaments, right? Those are right now the two things. If you look outside the Disc Golf Pro Tour and you look at players, professionals that play in A tiers or even B tiers, the things that draw those players to those tournaments are going to be big payouts or they know someone's going to be there to film. So for you to drag players from, or not drag, but for you to take players from the Disc Golf Pro Tour over to this hypothetical European tour, it's going to be those two things. Either the money and purses is really, really good, or the exposure of where they are able to somehow get a deal with some sort of national broadcasting or whatever it may be, to where you're like, hey, Disc Golf Pro Tour, average viewership, 50,000. European Tour, average viewership, 250,000. And like you said too, you could potentially even have other sponsors getting involved outside of just like the disc golf world. So what's the answer? I think as of right now, obviously the Disc Golf Pro Tour has a lot of momentum going and you're seeing European players come from Europe to the Disc Golf Pro Tour to play. So I think short term right now, I don't think that is going to happen anytime soon. But the tweet was future, the future of disc golf. And I'm not going to say it doesn't have a chance because I do think disc golf has the ability of becoming a top three sport, top five sport in some of these other countries, where in the United States, it's never going to be there.
Yeah.
Right. So if again, it's just a money situation of if people want to start putting the money and investing into some sort of European tour over there and they get the enough backers and all that stuff,
yeah,
then I can definitely see something popping off.
I personally think if it's going to happen, it's going to happen soon. Simply because the longer the Pro Tour gets established as the tour...
I don't think it has to be like that.
It'd be very... Like, for instance, in the NBA... It'd be very hard for, a European pro league to consider overtaking the NBA because the best European pro players want to be in the NBA.
Yeah, but where the Disc Golf Pro Tour is going to be in a couple years is going to be nowhere near where the NBA is right now.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying, though. When I say happen soon, I'm saying the next 5-10 years is my term of soon.
Because I think
there's going to get a point where... The Pro Tour, the U.S. Pro Tour has grown big enough that like right now, if a European tour started up, it would take one or two big sponsors like Nike, Patagonia, whatever. I don't know what's big in Finland or Europe. It would take one or two of them big sponsors to get the purses above what a Pro Tour. And I'm talking like if they threw money in.
Yeah.
It wouldn't take many to get the purses competitive.
Right.
And
now.
Then if they have the exposure to back it, then it's like, okay, like you said, now it's just that we're weighing our options versus if you let the Pro Tour develop 5 or 10 years,
yeah.
Now it's going to take a lot more than one or two sponsors. And then if they get two sponsors, they're not going to be able to draw even their top European pros to that tour because they're going to be on the Pro Tour circuit.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely there.
It gets harder and harder the longer time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely an interesting thing. And it's something that I don't think, I'm pretty sure Colin, it might be a different guy. I'm pretty sure he works with Prodigy. But I think it's something that a lot of manufacturers have realized or at least have it in the back of their head. Because if you look at Trilogy, Dynamic is their U.S. branch, but Latitude 64 is based in Sweden. That's like their main, that's where they manufacture everything, based in a European country. Discmania, based in a European country, has a U.S. branch. Prodigy, bigger in Europe than it is in the U.S. I think that's what a lot of people, Trevor and I included, would forget on Griplock sometimes. We talk about Prodigy this, Prodigy that. And then we literally had someone from Prodigy message us and was like, hey, just a reminder, here is the biggest, basically the biggest retailer in Europe. Here's their sales numbers from Q4. Prodigy tops it by a long shot because Prodigy's massive over there. And stuff like that to where and Innova has a big European presence to where manufacturers have realized that and they're kind of balancing it out to make sure, hey, if it blows up here, great. If it blows up here, great. We're in both places. And so if they're already if they've realized it for who knows how long past, you know, I don't think it's something that is completely off the table, but I do think that the more the Pro Tour develops and the Pro Tour expands into Europe a little bit and sets himself up as the tour, the harder it is for a European tour to overtake it.
Yeah, no, for sure.
It's kind of like there's no way the MLS overtakes the Premier League or La Liga or anything like that in soccer. Because, I mean, you're never going to get the players over here. There's also
so much history sometimes.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's the biggest thing is history mm-hmm. with it. Because even if you had money at DC United, you're not getting a top player until that top player is basically retired from Premier League and wants to keep playing. It's like, ah, well, I can go play for LA Galaxy and, you know, have some fun.
That would be interesting to have. Maybe Trevor to get someone, if we can get someone from the MLS, because that would be, I'd be very curious to hear from them, like their thoughts on what they're trying to do. Are they actually trying to become the biggest, like this is like where we want to,
like the director of the MLS?
Yeah. Like either director or like someone from like a team, someone that would actually have any idea, like the inside workings of like, do they just, are they okay with the place that they're in right now and they're just trying to make it the best as possible? Or do they actually have desires to try to be the biggest soccer league? And eventually, you know, 20 years from now, all the best soccer players are playing in their league. It'd be interesting to kind of see, you know, hear from someone in it to, you know, what are they trying to do? Because that is like when you, I've never really thought about that. Like the NBA, I've never really thought about like, are other leagues trying to overtake the NBA or are they just trying to increase their viewership? But they realize like there's no point into trying to put a lot of effort into trying to be the NBA because they're never going to. It'd be interesting.
That would be very interesting. I've never really thought of it until this conversation. I just threw it out there as an idea. I might skip one or two of these, but this one, this isn't really a debate topic. I'm just curious to hear, because I don't even know what this reference is, skill-wise.
Oh, geez.
But I think you'll have a good feel of it. I just want to curious what you think. So, this guy, Lucas Devine, said, shooting a perfect round in disc golf. And I think there's got to be some type of caveat on that, as like a perfect round on like a hard course, because shooting a perfect round like Peaceview Park isn't
Come
very
on,
impressive.
Man. Don't take that away from me.
Well, I mean, it's impressive, but it's
Don't
not.
Don't take that away from me.
It's not as impressive as what he's about to say. Shooting a perfect round in disc golf is less impressive than shooting a 58 in golf. Still yes. a great accomplishment nonetheless.
Yes.
So how? What is a 58 in golf? That's 14?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So that's not even...
It's only been done by one person.
Yeah, so that doesn't even make sense. I guess it's because he's saying like Paul shooting a 18 under at D-Glow. Really just D-Glow, because the one at Waco was modern day 15 under because they adjusted the pars.
Ricky shot a perfect round in a Las Vegas, I mean, it was a practice round, but Las Vegas video.
Yeah. So realistically, the only one we can use is the D-Glow course because I think that course is still in relatively good shape.
One person's ever done it in golf. There's way. Like,
no, yeah. But I'm saying my secondary question is what score would you give golf as an equivalent? If that makes sense.
Oh, equivalent to like a perfect round. It wouldn't be that far off of it. It'd probably be like a 60.
But I guess
61. Yeah,
because the same caveat I guess goes both ways. Because like a low 60 at certain courses in golf is nowhere near as impressive as a low 60 at a different course. And the same thing in disc golf.
So I believe the 58 was done at a par 71, not a 72. So I think he shot 13 under.
Yeah. As I say, because like for instance, Chris Dickerson shot like 19 under. But no one really talks about it because the course's par was very soft.
Mm.
And so when you like look at the course and the length, you're like, oh, okay, well, there's like a 500-foot par 5. Like, of course he eagled it. You know what I mean? And so I think there's a lot of caveats in that. I just read that and I was like, that could be a debate topic. I don't know. Turns out, wasn't really. I just thought it was like, could be something that...
Watch. If you haven't seen it, go look up Jim Furyk 58 and watch it, because it's like he just doesn't make a mistake an entire round. It's so impressive.
So this one I think is going to be right up your alley.
Oh, yeah.
Because we've talked about it on the show, and a lot of people brought this up as their most debatable take. I don't really think it's that debatable anymore. I think a lot of people agree with it. But the main take was that circle one should be extended.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't jump putt.
Mm-hmm.
But this take I hadn't heard yet. It was from Steve Abreu. hopefully I pronounced that last name right. He said, you shouldn't be able to step or jump putt into circle one. So if you're right outside, you can only move forward as far as the edge of the circle.
Interesting.
So like if you're step putting from 37 feet or 35 feet, you only have 2 feet in front of your lie.
Interesting.
I don't know how you'd enforce it as much, but I thought that was a newer take.
It would definitely add another element for players to have to look. I don't like it simply for that reason. I like it in the sense of where a 34 footer isn't become a closer putt than a 32 footer.
Yeah.
I like that, but I don't like the fact that right now we're already having players that don't like having to make calls on other players. So now you're basically adding another thing for players to have to watch to see like, oh, your toe touched the line. Like, and a lot of times we're playing courses that don't have lines.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we have to kind of, you know, you either eyeball and be like, okay, you're definitely outside of circle one and you can step putt, or you legitimately like use a rangefinder or whatever it is to see that you're outside. Cause sometimes we just have those little feather things that are like 15 feet apart from one another. So playing a course like that where there's not even a circle one line, like that just sounds
one thing
that sounds not fun.
I feel like we've talked about this. I don't know if it's on this show or on Grip Locked, but I just thought of it again. I don't remember where we landed on it, but the idea was essentially instead of having a designated like circle one is 50 feet and you can't jump putt within 50 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having that, almost making it where you can design greens.
Yeah. To where we've talked like, about that.
I think I like that idea more of where you can make it like, you know, oh, you want to finish long of this basket because the circle is 20 feet there. And if you end up short, it's 80 feet or type thing to where, oh, I can step putt on. I don't know. That's just something that I think the green and disc golf is a lot to be explored.
Yeah, I definitely think like the easiest way of making greens more exciting is just changing the length of the grass or changing the actual surface. So having potentially some spots where there's no grass at all, just leave it like basically dirt and like, you know, pack it down to where if you land it left of the basket, you're going to get a big flare skip further away, where if you land it right of the basket, it's going to like settle in the grass. You know, having different levels of grass, I think would make it, again, we're trying to find ways of making disc golf more challenging and at the same time making it to where you benefit better shots. So right now they have it set up to where there really isn't, when you throw a disc at a basket, there really isn't that much benefit of throwing a disc a foot from the basket versus 15 feet from a basket.
Yeah, your goal is just get close to the basket. And
with some of the best putters, their goal is to just get it within 25 feet.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you can kind of make it to where it's like, instead of having that circle of a good throw be 25 feet around the basket, if you can take out like a slice of that circle and be like, if you throw it in this slice, that's going to be a bad shot. Now you're making it to where better shots are going to get rewarded and worse shots are going to get penalized.
Yeah. Well, one course, and this course was very poorly done, in my opinion. But it made you think on every shot. It was called Dunipace Dunes at Nationals.
Yeah.
I hated it. But
I think we've talked about that a little on the banter potentially.
Yeah, it had pretty much every basket was on a dune. To where the thing I liked about it, I don't like it in general because it was very gimmicky and stuff like that. I think it was overdone, but the idea behind it I liked because no upshot or no shot was guaranteed. So if you're throwing a big spike hyzer into the side of this dune, then it's gonna roll away. You're lucky if it sticks. So you had to be very controllable about like your angle, and it was good to throw like a flex shot that flattened in. I love that about like hillside greens, to where you can't just chuck a disc and hope it sticks. You have to think through the angle control and stuff like that. And it also makes like a 250 foot shot not as routine. Because right now, if you put a pro in a wide open field 200 feet away from the basket, they're getting up and down every single time. There's if it's a wide open field, realistically, there's no reason a pro on tour is not getting up and down.
Other than if it's really windy. That's the only time.
But you can't design wind.
You can't design for that.
But as soon as you elevate the basket a little bit, not drastically, but enough to make someone think, as soon as you do what you said, change the grass a little bit, as soon as you add water or OB right behind the basket, as soon as you put it on a steep hill, all those things now make a player's approach shot, makes them think. And I think that's what we're missing somewhat in disc golf is just, A, I do agree the circle, if we keep it just a circle, needs to be bigger just so that at least the like 35, 40 footers, it's not like guaranteed if you're step putting that you basically you have a 25 footer or whatever. Because the best putters in the world, 35 feet, you can putt that just the same and your percentage will probably be pretty close. So there's no real need to have like a questionable weird step putt thing going on. But I do think it's very advantageous to have just the short game be more difficult.
It would just be more interesting, I think, for the viewers. One thing, too, you talked about putting the basket on top of a dune. Mm-hmm. Another thing you could do, and this was implemented, I don't know if on purpose or if it just was how the land was currently, but I believe it was the par five at the fort at Worlds where they had a pretty decent, I want to say maybe 12, 13-foot hill, like mound,
mm-hmm.
before the basket. And the basket was maybe 10 feet or so behind it. So if you know you had a lane out to the right to throw kind of a backhand hyzer in, and you had a lane out to the left to throw a forehand hyzer in, and if you were short, normally all that would mean is like on a normal basket where there's nothing like that in the way, you would just, you know, oh, you're just going to skip and you're going to skip up towards the basket.
End up close, yeah.
Here, there is no skip towards the basket because you're skipping into a mound. And now you basically are now on a mound and have a very difficult, if not impossible, putt over. So you're basically penalizing people for not having good distance control or angle control of being able to get in. So think about that too, of where, you know, maybe a hole you want to, because when a basket's on a hillside, it definitely dictates what kind of throw you can throw in. You can't just throw a backhand or a forehand, because a lot of times you want to be able to have the disc come into the hill versus it potentially just going down. So you could do, without having a hillside, you could do that same thing with mounding by putting a mound on one side of the basket. So now that basically means like, okay, I don't want the disc coming. If it's on the left side of the basket, I don't want a disc coming left to right, because if I miss, now I'm slamming into the mound and I'm going to have no putt. Now it forces me to throw a right to left shot in there. Yeah. So I think the mounding around the baskets too could also kind of, again, force players to have to throw certain shots versus right now, if you're just giving players the ability to throw their best shots all the time, you're going to see scores very low.
Which is a great transition into the final debate point from Twitter. I was trying to find a picture of, I have a picture of me looking up at this mound so you could understand why I don't like these, but I don't have it. I can't find it. It's on my Instagram somewhere, but the mound was like, legitimately 25 feet in the air, and I'm standing at the base of it looking up after my putt had just rolled back to me like,
we still need to do that video of where it's like the putting height challenge.
Oh yeah,
we need to rent out a
one of those like chair lift, or what do they call it, scissor lift.
Yeah, we need to rent out
a basket
and put a basket there
and you
like
make
each
it
round
and raise it five raise feet it up.
Oh
make
yeah
it, raise it five
that'd
feet.
Be fun. Yeah, that'd be easy to do too.
All right, final take from Twitter before we get into the Twitter spaces, from Mikey Tao, and he said courses do not need to get harder just because pros are scoring well. And his example that he used was the viewership count on the Preserve Championship, which was one of the lowest scoring tournaments of the year and one of the highest viewed tournaments of
that same
year. You're talking
about the first year it was on the tour?
Yeah. It might have been a Silver Series.
But the first time the Preserve was on the tour.
Correct. When it was in the easiest.
A lot of people watched it.
Well, yeah.
Is that? Yeah. So that
was his example. But essentially, the point behind it.
But he's saying a lot of people watched it, so that's the reason. He's saying the reason why a lot of people watched it is because the scores are so low.
That was one of the arguments.
I would say the reason why so many people watched it is no one has seen the course before. Cale LaVisca designed it. It was super hyped up and had an incredible finish.
Yeah,
that's probably why so many people watched it.
I think that the perfect balance is a weird one, because if the scores can go super low, if the course is very easy, there's not going to be a lot of scoring separation. With not a lot of scoring separation, that means you are most likely going to have a pretty exciting finish because players are going to be shooting 14, 15, whatever under. Issue with that is I don't think that the best players...
I disagree, though, with
you,
exciting
you don't think
finish.
So?
Yeah, I don't think necessarily...
Well, exciting finish in the scores-wise. It's not necessarily like... if someone has a lead, they're never blowing it.
Yeah.
I'm saying it's more likely to have an exciting finish where like three or four people are in it score-wise because they're within a few strokes.
So let me try to think about this before I say it, because I know people are going to be like, that made no sense at all, Brody. So when you play a course that let's just pick like a course that we know that you can go out and play really well at, right? So like everyone knows like an easy course you can go out and play really well at. When you have a bad day, you're probably going to shoot like 12 under.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kind of talked about this before. When you have a good day, you can shoot 18 under. You can birdie everything. So like you have like six shots that you're playing around with.
Yeah.
So that theory of like those type of style courses where people, like obviously that's the extreme, but the theory that people can go out and score a lot of birdies on and not really make any bogeys. You're basically just birdieing or par, birdieing or par. You're now shooting between 12 and 18 under. Your point being, a course like that, when you put a lot of pros on, there's going to be tons of pros shooting between 12 and 18 under. So you're going to have a lot of people in the mix.
Yes. Yeah.
So it will be exciting in the sense that you have a lot of people in the mix and you don't know who's going to win, kind of thing. But I think what's more exciting is when you have a course that a good round is 7 under, but if you go out there and you don't play well, you shoot 5 over, 6 over. So now the score separation there instead of 6 is now 13. The reason why I like that is because you could have two leaders that, let's say, after three rounds are, let's just say, they all played incredibly well. You know, they are now at 17 under. They went 5 under, 5 under, 7 under. They played three great rounds. They're 17 under. Some other guy played okay and went 4 under, 4 under, 4 under, and he's at 12. He's 5 shots back. He can go out and have a really good round and shoot 7 under, and these leaders could falter and shoot 1 under or even or something. And all of a sudden, you see this switch of like, this guy just went out and played really well.
Yeah.
To me, I think that's more exciting of like watching. And also just again, like when you watch the Preserve, it's a different type of tournament completely, because you're watching it and the pressure is players know I have to birdie to keep going. There isn't the pressure of, oh gosh, I could double. Like yeah. if I don't execute this shot, I can take a big number on this score. So it's two different types of pressure. I think some people are going to enjoy the birdie fest and just going out and birdie. And I'm not saying I don't think we should have tour stops that are like that. I think it does appeal to some people. But me personally, if I'm viewing disc golf, I think I'm more entertained when the majority of holes, I know players, if they play it well, can shoot birdie. And if they play it poorly, they can shoot bogey, double, triple.
Yeah.
And so now the wide variety of scores.
Well, it also makes that.
Can make like big jumps from.
Yeah.
Because really when it's like birdie or die type of courses, the jumps are very small. Like, oh, one shot lead. Oh, they're tied. Oh, now he took the lead, one shot lead. Oh, back tied. Now what? Versus this guy just birdied and this guy doubled. Now all of a sudden there's a three shot swing.
Yeah. Well, also at a birdie or die tournament, if, let's just say, Paul and Ricky are battling it out, and Ricky has a three-stroke lead with three to play,
it's over.
He's not losing that. Versus you take that same scenario and you put it at a USDGC. You put it at a Northwoods Black or anywhere like that.
Maple Hill has a good little home stretch.
You put it at a course like that, three strokes with three to play is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm still glued to the screen. I think it's a different type of excitement. If all you care about is like the final score was you had Eagle win at 19 at, well, over four rounds, you had Eagle win at 40 something under par, and let's just go Eagle at 40, and then you had Paul and Ricky at 38, and then you had Conrad at 37, and then you had Kevin, and mm-hmm. and like there's the top 10 are all within five strokes of each other. If that's the definition of exciting, then sure, you're going to get that more at the birdie or die course.
Mm-hmm.
But if the definition of exciting is going into the final round, the top 15 all have a shot at it, then that's where you're going to need difficult courses, because 15th place going into the final round might be seven strokes back at a birdie or die course. And like you're saying, no matter how bad they play, this person is not catching the lead at a birdie or die course.
I'll have the perfect example.
Boom.
Perfect example.
Let's hear it.
How many times do you see someone post a score in disc golf and the commentators be like, that's the score to beat? Very few times do you ever see someone that is, you know, there's 10 guys still out in the course, 15 guys still out the course, and someone posts a score and these guys are on hole 13 and they're being like, all right, 38 under is the score to beat, and these guys are at 36, right? Like, no one's going to talk about the 38 under because everyone knows these guys that are 36, one of them is going to shoot 44, birdie. 42, yeah. 40, whatever it is. One of them is going to. So I think that's what you're talking about, of where the excitement, when you have these birdie or die courses, as soon as your number, so if you shoot 38 under, and as soon as that number gets passed by one of the leaders, you're out.
Yeah, it's done.
The tournament's over. Versus you shoot 38 under, and yeah, maybe someone shoots, or not 30. In this instance, it'd be like you shoot 15 under for the tournament, and someone shoots 16 under and still has five holes left. Now we're talking about, can this guy just hold on?
Yeah.
Can he just survive these last couple holes and win? Versus in a birdie or die tournament, you shoot 36 under and the guy shoots 37. Now it's like, okay, how much is he going to win by? Mm-hmm. Is he going to win by 4, 5, 6? So I think that's the difference too, of where different excitement, obviously, yeah. And one's not better than the other. Obviously, some people are going to disagree with what we think, but I do think it puts a little more pressure on players when a score gets posted, similar to like the Paul Kyle Klein situation, where Kyle finished, and that was a little bit closer, obviously, but at USDGC, you could have someone play really well the final round, post a score, and then it's like the guy coming in has to play 15, 16, 17, 18. Can he hold on?
Yeah, he needs to
can he survive?
One under through those final holes. And even when he gets at USDGC, when you get through 15 and 16, if you have a two-stroke lead over the clubhouse, mm-hmm. right, then it's not over because you got 17.
Yep.
It's like 17, you throw one shot OB, boom, it's gone.
And even 18. 18 is a tough, like even yeah. if you play 18 for par.
18 gets overshadowed because of 17.
Yeah, 18 is not a hole where it's like, oh, if you play it, because some of these birdie or die courses, if you're like, I just have to play for par and I win, it makes the hole so easy.
The one thing I will say that I think, because I've heard this argument a lot, whenever we bring it up, there's a very polarizing argument of courses should be harder, courses should be easier. The one thing I will say that I think drives kind of a wedge between is how people consume the disc golf. Because if you're consuming post-production as your main way,
true.
And you're watching the lead card, at a birdie or die course, probably 8 times out of 10, someone on that lead card is winning. Versus, you know, at USDGC, great example, if you're watching live, you get to see Kyle's round kind of coming to a close, and it's a storyline building, building, building. And then you get to see Paul come down, and like you're saying, the score's set. Can Paul hold on? You know, building, building, building. You get to see both of those happening at the real time. So it doesn't matter that there's someone on the lead card that's completely out of it, and you don't have to watch their shots, because why does it matter what Drew Gibson's throwing right now, because he's 5 strokes back, but these guys in the chase card matters. And if that's how you're consuming it, that's going to be a lot more exciting versus if you're consuming it on post and there's only one guy in it and it's like, oh, Paul ran away with it. And then you get to the end and you're like, oh my word, he's in a playoff. They'll mention Kyle Klein's shot here and there, and they might get some footage thrown in, but I think it's also two different.
It's true.
Entertaining in two different ways.
What you just said, I think might be the nail in the coffin. Like, that's probably the reason why the birdie or die courses are so fun to watch post-produce. Because you're just seeing the guys that are going to win.
Yeah.
You're seeing the best shots. You're seeing all that stuff.
Yeah. Versus
live, you're seeing, like, the changes in score and all that stuff.
Yeah, because in
Because live, in preserved, how many times did they show someone else?
I don't know.
I think they showed Simon, who was like maybe on second or third card one time because he threw in a shot. Or maybe he was on feature card on the final hole.
I'm not sure.
Or not feature, but lead. I can't remember.
Oh, he was on chase. He was on chase because he had a chance. If he eagled, it was something like that.
Something crazy. So like, I think they showed some like highlights like that, but it's going to be harder for you to really show that many people in the hunt in those, because the four people on Lee Card the final day, it's going to be tough for four people to all of a sudden just have really, really bad rounds.
Yeah, well, also in post, they know the stories. They know the storyline before mm-hmm. they create it. So if so-and-so charges, we'll use Drew Gibson again. If Drew Gibson charges from the third card and is in the lead at some point, and then and like through nine holes, he's technically in the lead, two holes ahead of the lead card, and then he falls off and is nowhere to be seen, that's a non-story. So they might throw it in there because it's fun, or they might not, and doesn't affect the post-production. Live production, that's a thrilling storyline. Because they're like, hey, you know, just a storyline. Here's some clips of Drew Gibson two holes back or two holes ahead of our leaders. With that stroke, he is now two holes and two strokes ahead of the leaders. And then you see that fall off. But that's a whole nother dynamic that I think that's why in my head, I'm always watching disc golf live. That's how I consume it personally. It's my personal preference. And so when I'm thinking of what's most entertaining, that's why my head goes there versus birdie or die courses.
Good point. All right, some Twitter space action.
Yeah.
All right, we'll do a little Twitter space action, and we'll wrap it up. We'll see what people are thinking on. I need to share a tweet. See what people are thinking on Twitter.
Brody, there's someone wanting to know in the chat. Where you got that shirt from?
This is Bad Brody.
There you go.
Boom.
No one wants to know where I got... Oh, my God. Kelsey just scared the crap out of me. Did you know she was there?
I saw her walk in. She scared me when she opened the door.
Oh, my gosh. She scared you when she opened the door, you said?
Yeah, she opened that door, and I thought we were about to get in trouble. I thought it was like someone in like one of these other units being like, why are these guys yelling at... Well, it's only 6 o'clock now. I'm used to it being 10 o'clock right now.
Silas, I'll give you a blizzard if you know what my hat is.
Your hat?
Yeah.
Washington Generals?
Yeah.
It's a basketball team.
What kind?
No,
don't go on Google.
Okay.
No Google.
All right, I won't Google. It's a basketball doesn't have like minor leagues.
Basketball does not have minor leagues. You're correct.
So it's got to be. It's not a national. It's not in the NBA.
It's not in the NBA.
Yeah. It's got to be a college.
So what college?
Oh, what college? Washington Generals, University of Washington.
He nailed it.
Is that it?
No, it's the team. They have never won a basketball game.
What?
I believe their record is 0 and like 182 or something.
I actually don't even know this team, to be fair.
Oh, okay.
I was just gassing. They're the team that... I knew it wasn't the University of Washington. That's all I didn't know.
First off, we want to welcome everyone to Twitter Spaces. Hello, everyone. We'll get to some calls here in a second. But the Washington Generals, they are the team that plays the Harlem Globetrotters.
There was no clue I was getting that.
Yeah. No, that, well, I mean, Harlem Globetrotters is a big deal. Big deal.
Yeah, but you never know who there's a reason you know the Harlem Globetrotters, not the Washington Generals. Because
they always win and the Generals always lose.
Exactly. All right, if you're on Twitter Spaces and you got a debate topic you want to bring up, you can raise your hand and... we'll unmute you, bring you in.
Wait, you were whistling the theme song?
Well, I think that's like the song they play when they start.
I thought
like,
that was Jeopardy. That you
that, no, that's
what
song,
someone said. I was like,
yeah,
what?
When they start dribbling the basketball around and stuff, and like you know, the whole team's like chasing after him. It's like dun 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 dun. All right, let's add in Mike. We got Mike here.
Mike.
Mike, you're on. What's up? Oh, wait. He's connecting.
Oh, not quite on yet.
Why am I not on the Wi-Fi? Oh, no.
You're on the Wi-Fi.
I almost went airplane mode. I don't know what that would have
been.
What would that have done?
Maybe nothing if you were on the Wi-Fi in airplane mode.
Now I'm on Wi-Fi.
All right, Mike.
All right, Mike. Unmute yourself and you're good to ask away.
Hey, guys. Hey, appreciate this earlier start. I don't have to pound coffee to stay awake, so that's pretty awesome. I'm going to start off by saying carrots aren't a treat, and then we can move on.
Thank you very much.
So I have my specific debate thing, but I thought that was a cool topic you guys brought up about the greens. I think that the idea of having designed greens at a course could make a course go from an okay course or even a bad course to a great course, because you could move it around elevation with trees, things like that. And I mean, you look at regular golf, and there's some courses that are known for huge greens, which would benefit, I guess I don't exactly know how it would benefit, who it would benefit in disc golf to make bigger greens. I guess the guys who don't jump putt as close, but, and then there's places with smaller greens and, you know, things like that. So, and I think the way putting is tracked now anyway is pretty bad. The idea of one stat from 30 feet to 60 feet, it doesn't give us any idea of how good these people are from putting. The problem is I don't know how we would track putting. Like, you look at golf and they have it, I think, by every 5 feet or so, I think.
When
they
have percentages, it's less than that, but yes, I think sometimes it's even 3 feet.
So I don't know realistically how disc golf could do that at the moment, just because I don't know. And Brody, maybe you know, I don't know how they track stuff like that. I know they use some data and like actual like satellite stuff for certain stats for golf, but obviously we're far away from that. But I think adding specific size greens and letting the TDs do that, that'll also highlight good TDs and bad TDs. I think that would be an amazing way to change things. But that's a really cool point. But I want this to be a debate, so I'm trying to think of something pretty outlandish, but I do think I believe this, so I'm going to run with it. Paige Pierce will not win a Disc Golf Pro Tour event with the big three from Europe at that event this year. So if all three, Kristen, Evelina, and Hannah are there, Paige will not win a single event with those three at the event.
So the take that you have isn't honestly as outlandish as people maybe think when they hear it. Mainly because right now, the only events that we know all three of them that are going to be at is like there's four or five events.
Okay, let me update my take then. Assuming, let's just say in a perfect world, they're at 80% or more of Disc Golf Pro Tour events, I will hold to that take.
That's impressive. Yeah, because right now, it looks like all the Europeans have done basically the same thing where they're like, hey, this is our early season touring, and I think they're going to leave after kind of the Texas swing, and then I'm assuming they're probably going to come back at like some Worlds, point, yeah, and do a couple more. So I don't know exactly how many events they'll end up. But it's gonna be tough. I mean, it's gonna be tough for sure, because obviously you have a couple players that have gotten definitely better, I would say, in the last year to 2 years. And I think Paige is going to be in a spot, and it's gonna be interesting to see how her offseason went. Because I think she's in a spot to where she can basically decide, you know, or not basically decide, but she can come in and say, like, I am still the most dominant FPO player out there, and go out and win. Or you're going to have a situation where instead of her having to just beat a handful of girls last year, she now has those, you know, I would say like Haley King's probably going to be better coming into this year. You have Kona Panis is probably going to be better coming into this year. Kat potentially could be better. Missy Gannon. You're going to have some of these women that are still kind of not reached their peak yet. And then obviously throwing in the European women as well. It's going to be interesting.
Well, I think... I think the take is a little bit outlandish from the point of view that where it's going to be hard for Paige to beat them, harder than when they're not in the field. I don't think that they're that much better, if better than Paige. I think they're on her level.
Would you bet? Would you bet the first five, like the first five events? Would you bet
that Paige wins one of them?
That would Paige wins one of them.
The first five,
because those are the ones that we know that they're all going to be.
You know
be
what?
At.
Yeah, I trust. Here's my thing. I think that if Paige shows up, like she's capable.
Before you give this point, can I give you some info you guys may or may not know?
Oh, gosh.
Sure, go for it. Yeah.
Okay, so we have a little bit we can work off of here. We obviously have Kristen. She was here for four events last year.
Mm-hmm.
Paige finished higher than her in one of those four events.
Mm-hmm.
The other three, Kristen won two of them and then placed higher in the other one. And so this is a little bit of a stretch, but I'm going to go with it. So in the last 16 matchups Kristen's had against the other two Europeans, against Salonen, she's only beat Salonen 3 out of those 16 times. And Blumroos, she's only beat 5 out of the 16 times. So she beat Paige 3 out of the 4 times when she was here. And if we're going to say, well, Paige can beat every once in a while, but she's not even beating Salonen and Blumenrose on a consistent basis. They're beating her much more often than she's beating them.
That's pretty good stats. So it's pretty good stats.
It's even if we're like, well, you know, Paige had this, Paige had that. She only beat her one out of four times. And based on what we have, she's the third best in Europe right now.
Yeah, no, I'm aware of most of the stats you just brought up. And like I said, I know this is why Trevor and I on Grip Lock have talked about this multiple times, that the FPO field this year, when all of them are present, is going to be just thrilling, because
it's gonna be awesome.
You have Katrina Allen, who can get in the mix. You have Paige Pierce, who will be in the mix here and there. The biggest thing for Paige is some tournaments she shows great resiliency and can make up like eight strokes in one round. Mm-hmm. She's not going to be able to do that against Kristen, Evelina, Henna. One of them, if they have an eight-stroke lead,
they're not going to collapse.
They're not going to collapse. They might collapse. Less likely for them to collapse. So if Paige gets off to a bad start, now it might be kind of over, and it's interesting to see if she'll mentally check out and accept that or not. But I still stand by when Paige is playing to her full potential, when mm-hmm. she has all is firing on all cylinders, she's the best player in FPO. I will stand by that until I see it happen, where Paige averages, you know, play. I don't want to use ratings because who knows what a good rating is right now. Where Paige plays and we can all agree that was a great round over and over by Paige, and she still loses. Until that happens, I will think that if Paige shows up and plays her best, she's still going to beat Evelina, Henna, Kristen, all of them. But I do agree that when they're all in the field, it's going to be Paige basically has to beat three of herself every week.
So you just think Paige has the highest ceiling, and you think she's going to reach that ceiling at one of the first five events?
I don't think I think one of the first five, she's not going to have to, because the tournament that Kristen.
Interesting. All right.
The tournament that Kristen, I believe, lost to Paige at, maybe the first. You said only one of the four she lost to Paige?
Yeah.
Yep.
So the first
she
one.
She only lost to Paige at Worlds, I believe.
Okay. Well, so, but Kristen, when she first came over, I think she lost her first two events she was over here. One of them, she must have beat Paige, and then won her last two. So to me, I think when they first get over here,
Paige
they have.
Wins Vegas.
I don't know if Paige wins Vegas. That's the tough one, though, because Vegas, it's a wide open course. Evelina's won it in the past or been close to winning it in the past. Evelina won Waco. She was close to winning Vegas. I just think that there's going to be a little bit of a slow, like, knock the rust off. We're on the Pro Tour moment, and I think Paige will be able to win it without having to be her best at one of the first one or two tournaments. Come tournament three through five, yeah, it's going to take several rounds of her best to beat all of them, because it's hard to imagine Paige, Evelina, Henna, Kristen, and Kat all showing up to, and that doesn't even include Missy, Haley, any of them.
Kona.
All five Holcomb. Of the ones I just listed, all of them showing up to an event and at least not one of them popping off.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine that world. And I think that's going to be super exciting.
It's gonna be really exciting. Really exciting. All right, Mike. Thanks for calling in, man. That was a good one.
Yeah, I appreciate it. One last little thing.
Yeah.
FPO, as scary as it seems, it's even scarier when you consider that Evelyn and Henna are only 22 years old, so it's going to be fun for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And more. And looks like the youth over in the Europe is, there's a lot of young talent over there too, so it should be good for many years. All right. We've got this one.
Team backstage.
You are on. What's up?
Nice. All right. So I have something to talk about with the sponsors and marketing side of things for disc golf.
Awesome. Let's hear it.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with Backstage Organics, but we sponsor some of the players, and our little niche is, you know, bringing in the healthy side of things, like, you know, organic brands and grocery stores. And so, you know, it's been a challenge. I have to let people know who know me when I'm playing here in San Francisco or De La Viega, know the issues, but really it's the director of marketing. I'm talking with a lot of director of marketings. We have, you know, 15 brands that a lot of people, you know, well-known brands, and they're more times than not, the first thing out of their mouth is like, that's a party sport. Mm. And they're reluctant to align with it because the demographic for, you know, any given, you know, organic brand or an, you know, healthy, you know, product is going to be more like the yoga, Whole Foods mom kind of demographic. And so it's been very challenging to get new sponsors to come to the sport because of that. Now, that being said, you know, I get it. There's two sports really for me, if you play in the morning or if you play in the afternoon. So in the morning on weekdays, you tend to get the more athletic side of things. And then anytime really like after 10 or 11 is when the party aspect of the sport starts to come out. I'm not sure how it is, because I've only played in San Francisco and in Santa Cruz, but I mean, even the party sport, those guys are all awesome people and they're fun and all that. And you definitely, it's not a safe place for kids to be coming out and learning disc golf though. So I just want to get your guys' take on that. And, you know, the extraordinary thing though, I'll have to say, like, for people, you know, who are on our team, like Ricky and Eagle and Kona and players like that, if you know about social media, their conversion rates are extraordinary. So let's say Eagle has 118,000 followers on Instagram. Any given post, he's going to have 15,000 to 20,000 views. Now, when you go to any other type of like music influencer or something like that, it's more like the 1% to 2% conversion rate. So if you had 118,000 followers, you might only get like 7,000 views. So I see the light at the end of the tunnel for disc golf, but there certainly is a challenge.
So
what are your thoughts?
Well, I would first disagree with the percentage things of like there's the notion of social media is the more followers you get, the smaller that number gets, the smaller your percentage is. So if you go to like someone that has like 50 million followers and you look at their posts, the amount of people that are looking at that, which really actually should be, it's going to be even smaller in the sense that their posts are going to be in a lot of people's algorithms and stuff. So if you actually looked at the people that follow them that see it, it's probably gonna be much smaller than someone that has 40,000 Instagram followers. And you look at YouTube. YouTube's a perfect example too of like when you start a YouTube channel and you have 500 subscribers, you're basically, those people have just subscribed and they're very engaged in what you're posting. You get to the point where you have 10 million subscribers. A lot of those subscribers are like, you know, they might be 5 years old and they've grown out of it. So I'll say with that, the other thing though that you said about like the party thing, how is disc golf more of a party sport than golf?
Good question. Well, I think the main difference is golf is you pay to play, and it's a whole different mindset, I think, when you're
what makes paying. Disc golf, I guess, party? Like what?
Well, maybe we're unique here in San Francisco then, because it's just you know, alcohol, cigarettes, weed.
That's on golf courses all the time.
Yeah, but again, I think it might just be different here.
Golf, it's probably more likely to see someone drinking alcohol because they literally have cart ladies that go around to try to get you to buy alcohol.
Yeah, that's a good point.
What when you're talking to these companies, I guess I don't have a full understanding of what you exactly are doing. Because whenever I've seen you on like shared on people's stories and stuff, and I assumed you were like a organic food retailer sponsoring. So when you say you're talking to these companies and trying to sell them, are you like selling them on them sponsoring players? Like you're kind of an in between person, or like what are you selling to these other companies that they're saying this about disc golf?
Yeah, I'm not selling anything. It's just all social media, you know, so they're sending out these players, you know, snacks, healthy snacks and products. And in return, the players are posting up a thank you. And so it's really symbiotic relationship because these brands are actually much bigger than these players. And they're bringing new eyes and new followers to their page. So that's really what's happening is we just represent a whole bunch of brands because we have two grocery store chains, Natural Grocers and Earth Fair. And so all these brands are in their stores. So we're basically having these players stop into those stores along the pro tour, you know, pick up all these items and promote these brands and saying, you know, this is a healthy alternative snack. And it's pretty basic. So there's nowhere to buy it or anything. And there's no real money exchange on that end, but you know, Backstage Organics just gets paid to have these, you know, consistent influencers, you know, posting up about these certain brands.
Okay, so you guys are a store?
No, we're not a store. No.
We have store partners.
I think he's the middle person in between brands.
Yeah, so that's where I'm confused. If the players are only getting product, then
he's basically reaching out to brands to say, "Hey, can you get these players to? Are you willing to give your product to these players to promote it?"
Exactly.
So essentially, if a player wanted to, a player could theoretically reach out to the brand and say, "Hey, I really like your."
So the brands are basically saying, like, we don't want any part in disc golf. We're not even going to send a granola bar to the player.
Because they're not in their eyes, I'm guessing, is they're not in their market of people they're trying to market to.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, and that is happening. And they're not going to want to repost, you know, Instagram stories because it doesn't really fit in line with their, you know, demographic that they're trying to market to.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think the perception is a older rooted perception because, you know, disc golf, when I first got into disc golf, if you told anyone you played disc golf, it was immediately like met with, oh, it's a hippie sport
or the party sport,
what, you know, whatever it may be.
I just think
that I've hit that wall a lot less over the past few years to where, for instance, with our content, we've been able to successfully get outside, you know, Manscaped with our podcast, Raid Shadow Legends, Rocket League, Boxer Company, where all these companies have nothing to do with disc golf, but they're willing to associate simply because the viewership and the engagement, like you were saying. And not once have I had to answer, A, what is disc golf? Or B, oh, we're not going to do that because it's a hippie sport. So I think it's just something that's changing as the sport develops, and there's not really anything we have to focus on more or less. It's just as something gets more popular, people realize, because I think it's just something that's immediately thrown on, because like Brody was saying, that's something that happens in golf
the only thing I would say is like smoking weed. I don't know enough about the topic to like, I don't think it's illegal to smoke weed, is it?
It depends on locations.
But is in certain states, is it legal to smoke weed?
Yeah.
In parks and stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that doesn't bother me. You know, it doesn't bother me personally.
That's the only thing that I don't see that often on golf courses is like guys lighting it up. I have seen it, but I've definitely have seen it more on disc golf than golf courses. But like, I mean, I've seen way more hammered people on golf courses than I have on disc golf courses. So,
right. I think you're right, though. I think it's just going to take a little time, you know, give it a couple more years and a few more players. You know, big influencers in the sport are really pushing, you know, the health side of things, and it just will evolve in that way. But I just thought, I wasn't sure if like San Francisco, you know, was unique in that way, or if that's just kind of across the board. You know, most you know, public disc golf courses are going to have definitely that party element to it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just sports in general depends on, you know, the people playing it. I mean, heck, I've seen kickball games get out of control. So I think it literally just depends on the people. So, all right. Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
Great podcast.
Thank you so much.
Later.
All right. Let's take one more. Who do you want? Who are you feeling? Does this guy say unathletically disc golf?
Mikey Tao's the one who said scores disc golf should have like more easy. But Hardy's raising their hand.
Okay, we've already hit on that. So let's see if we can debate something. I would have gone in on the party disc golf golf, but it sounded like he kind of, once I said golf does the same thing, it didn't sound like he was going against that.
Yeah,
but go ahead, Hardy,
what you got?
Hey, so I was just thinking that SoCal needs to be a part of the Pro Tour. I know it probably once was, but I feel like the fan base would be huge, a bunch of money for the sport. I'm not going to drive all the way up to Stockton, 9 hours away, just to watch some disc golf.
Yeah, I think right now the Pro Tour is focused.
The West Coast is small.
The West Coast Tour is small. Yeah, well, I think right now the Pro Tour's number one focus is the courses.
Mm-hmm.
And which at this point it probably should be. That probably makes sense. But I agree. Like, there's realistically a Pro Tour, the Pro Tour championships in Charlotte. But I mean, if they had another Pro Tour stop in Charlotte or in there's a number of like really hotbeds in disc golf that like you could grow, like the crowds and stuff you could gather would be much bigger there than some of the other stops. Mm-hmm. But I think right now what they're focused on is the courses, the scoring, the cell service, all of that stuff, and all lining up perfectly to where they can provide the package to people who aren't driving to watch the Disc Golf Pro Tour in person but are watching it online, and focusing on that stuff first, to where I think that's their main focus. I don't know what the courses are like in SoCal. Don't think I've ever been to SoCal, because I don't, honestly, SoCal, NorCal kind of all confuse me. I've only been to, I don't even know if it's San Diego or San Francisco that I've been to, which everyone has Golden Gate Bridge. I've been to that one.
I don't think San Francisco is really SoCal.
I'm just saying, I don't know where the line is in the state. You know what I mean?
Right. San Francisco would be North Cal, and then LA, San Diego is SoCal.
Nice. Yeah. So like I said, I think that the Pro Tour's focus right now is course first, figure out the rest of the other stuff kind of second. But I will say, from what I've seen with like these wraparound events and stuff like that, I do think that we might see the Pro Tour kind of expand a little bit more, to where there might get a point where there's more events on the Pro Tour and all the players aren't playing all the events, mm-hmm. to where there might be where it hits the West Coast twice and the East Coast twice and then crisscrosses, and to where there's some players that just are like, I'm not playing all of them for whatever reason. And you're going to have your key events like a Ledgestone, Idlewild, MVP Open, where everyone's at those, but then you might have a Tallahassee Open or some, you know, SoCal Open get on there where it is a Pro Tour event, but it's not like a huge feature event yet. I could see stuff like that happening in the future.
Nice.
Yep. That's it. Thank you guys.
Appreciate it, Hardy.
Appreciate it.
Take it easy, man.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. We'll do one more. That was a quick one. We'll do one more. Raise your hand though, if you've requested and actually have a debate, something that you either disagree with Hunter or myself, or even Dark Horse Silas, you might disagree.
Probably a lot of people disagree with Silas.
Cause if you have a question, we're going to
give me a hot take.
We're trying to avoid questions. We're looking for more people that have something that they want to debate on.
All right, what if they made an island that was all sand? That way,
what do you mean?
Okay,
most islands are all sand.
No, he's saying in disc golf. I'm saying in disc golf, that was all sand, so you wouldn't be able to skip off of it
to make it easier.
But make the island pretty small, like a lot smaller.
Ooh. How do you get to the island? A canoe?
Yeah, you know.
The unathletic
wild. I see what you're saying though. Like, you know? A good shot is like,
yeah,
hitting
I saw someone say that in the comments. I thought it was cool.
I don't mind that. I think like the beach hole on USDGC kind of is like that, of where if you get a disc to land in the sand, you're good.
Yeah.
But if you land too far, then you can actually kind of skip over all the sand. So. Yeah.
Unathletically Disc Golf was the first to raise their hand after you said that. So
we'll see. I like that name too. So we'll do it.
All right. Let's see what you got.
What's the topic you have? The Caesar situation.
I would say my topic is that I think the leadership of the PDGA is probably holding the sport back. Just because it seems especially with Worlds and how kind of toxic everything turned out around that time frame, with Brody renting out the driving range and how they reacted to Paige Pierce's tweets, that it's almost becoming a toxic leadership. It's kind of holding the sport back.
Man, that's tough. I definitely think the leadership that was in place at that current time, could not agree more. I think the reason that guy, because mainly it was coming from one guy, and he was the president of the board of directors. We won't say his name because he doesn't need free ads. But the reason I think that he was acting in that way is he had already said, I'm stepping down from the PDGA. So he kind of felt free. And so he basically, while he still had a voice, voiced his opinion, whether or not it is the representation of how the PDGA currently felt. That's up for debate from people, but it made it seem kind of like the PDGA as a whole was taking a stance against certain players. Some of their other actions have made that feel that way as well, backed it up, kind of like U.S. Women's was a whole debacle with Paige. There was several things at Worlds, you know, that did not go to plan. But in their credit, they have taken some steps in this offseason to where it seems like they're at least somewhat aware of some of these things. And, you know, we'll have to see this year what happens. Because at the end of the day, I mean, I agree there's been a lot at the PDGA that's been done wrong. But there's also been a lot at the PDGA that's been done right. And nothing that exists currently the way disc golf is would exist without the PDGA and without the way that they, some of the decisions and stuff they have made. So, you know, I think that there's stuff that they could be doing better, obviously. And I think that one of the biggest keys, and hopefully it's something they're focusing on this year, is transparency, so that we can see not just the decision that, like, hey, what the heck, that makes no sense, but, you know, players can actually be involved in that decision before it happens. I think that's a big thing that needs to be going on. And also transparency to the public of, you know, why we're about to make these decisions. These are the decisions we're thinking of, so on and so forth.
Should we be bringing, so then we should be bringing forth like a players union to push that along.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the full right answer is. I do know that, like, for instance, at the Champions Cup, I saw they had, like, people from Bushnell and all this stuff out, but they had Yuli there, and his title that they put under him in the video was something like head of the player committee or something like that at the PDGA. What that exactly means, I don't know, but essentially it seems like Yuli is the representative for players, to where at least there's someone who can make players' voices heard, so that at least that, you know, there's steps that are being taken. The biggest thing is, like, are those steps being taken so that things like are what's happening right now happen, to where I'm like, oh, you know, hey, this is good. The PDGA seems to be listening, blah, blah, blah. And then they make the same mistakes and they don't expect us to do what we would do if they made the mistakes and be like, hey, this sucked. Why are you doing it this way? Who knows? So hopefully it's not just a PR move of like, hey, we kind of got burnt a little bit by the fire last year. Let's make sure we make some moves this offseason so people think we're all good, and then they do the same thing. That would suck, and I would be on the same page as you. But we'll at least see what happens this year.
And I don't know if they're being aggressive enough personally, because if you look at other sports and compare disc golf to other bigger sports, it seems like their governing bodies are a lot more aggressive towards promoting the sport than the PDGA seems to be, because they're not. Maybe they're not being as public, like you say, but transparency might help that.
Yeah, I think that's one thing I've advocated for on several occasions, is I think that some of their marketing at times can be a lot of like player-based, like what Paul did on the course, what Paige did on the course, what Ricky did, yada, yada, yada. I think a lot of their marketing, and this information is available if you look for it, but I would like it to be kind of pushed forward a little bit of like, hey, your membership dollars, this is how your membership dollars are going to grow the sport in X, Y, or Z. Or this is what we're using for marketing at X, Y, or Z event that we think has a really good crossover demographic with disc golf. Or hey, the PDGA has a booth set up at this year's outdoor, you know, whatever show, trade show, to where you see stuff like that of like they are taking that next step. Because I agree, I think a big portion of the future of disc golf just doesn't know the sport exists yet, or they know the sport exists but has no idea the Pro Tour or the PDGA exists. And getting that next step of like, hey, the sport you're playing every weekend with your buddies, you can come watch the best in the world play it an hour from you, or whatever it may be, a few weekends from now. And like, who knows how many people are in that market of they're playing disc golf week in and week out and have no idea that there's a Pro Tour or a Professional Disc Golf Association or anything like that going on, just because we're kind of marketing in a circle back to the same people.
All right, sounds good.
Appreciate it. Thanks for calling in.
Let's do one more, because Mikey is going nuts right now.
All
right,
Mikey.
Comments, and he wants to add to his point, and I don't want to deal with his wrath that he will give me on Twitter if we don't get him in here. So,
All right, Mikey,
finish it off. You're good to go. Oh, no, the blunder of a century.
Mikey?
He didn't want the smoke.
No, he wanted to give the smoke. He wanted to give it, but he's not able to.
He unmuted himself.
Oh, man.
He's not able to.
Can you hear us, Mikey?
He remuted.
Now he's unmuted.
Oh, no, Mikey.
All
it's, right, it's, next week, Mikey.
It's hard to watch the great ones fall.
Next week, Mikey will try. I guess we'll just end on this person because they just raised their hand 18,000 times in a row.
Christian, what do you got?
Let's finish with a banger.
All right. Can y'all hear me?
We can hear you.
All right, so I got a guaranteed debate. So I'm going to pose a question or ask a question, and whatever side that y'all take, I'm going to take the other one.
Okay.
All right. So the question is, are performance-enhancing drugs good for the sport of disc golf? And there's going to be a little caveat. By performance-enhancing drugs, I mean specifically like things like testosterone, anabolic steroids, not things that are illegal, like according to like the U.S. government, like obviously like cocaine, things like that, but specifically things that are illegal in the sport of football or baseball, basketball, that
Adderall
enhance the human body. Yeah, things like that. I think, or yes, not think. My question is, should those be legal in disc golf?
I think as a, at right now, there's no real way to make it illegal, just because like it would be the pro tour would have to kind of be the one enforcing it, because the PDGA, the issue is the PDGA encompasses a wide range of like, we're not drug testing a local C tier. So yeah, the pro tour would kind of have to be the one to do it.
Yeah. Specifically for the pro tour. Yeah. Do you think it would be a good thing or a bad thing that they are legal?
I don't see where it would be a bad thing to make them illegal, if that makes sense. I don't think it's good. I don't think there's like a, I don't have a hard stance on one way or the other. It's just like, what's the negative in making certain ones that are proven to be performance enhancing illegal? Is my, okay, my take on it, I guess.
All right, Brody, I don't know if you're able to speak on that, because I'm not sure if you're like contractually obligated.
Oh, no, I'm not contractually obligated for anything.
He is, however, on steroids.
I am on THC.
TMZ of disc golf, right?
Yeah, for me, I mean, I think, you know, the reason why a lot of sports don't allow it is because they want to try to make the playing field for everyone as equal as possible. And when you start making it to where, you know, guys in baseball are taking Adderall and the ball looks like a watermelon when it's getting thrown at them, the playing field changes. And so then you get like, okay, so is everyone in baseball just going to start taking Adderall? Do we want kids that are 16 years old starting to take steroids because that's what everyone's doing in the NFL? And for the, you know, it gets down a real slippery slope fast. And so that's where I think,
that's where I tried to classify specifically ones that were more on the physical side of things, just like as of like testosterone boosters or anabolic steroids to build muscle mass, because I guess since y'all didn't necessarily, I guess, take a side, just kind of like neutral, my argument was that it could be good for the growth of disc golf, because like specifically in the pro tour, because the biggest thing that is, I guess, your everyday player from making it to the pro tour is primarily distance. Like, people can work on putting and become a good putter from circle one, circle two, whatever, but not everyone's going to be able to throw 500 feet. That's just genetics. And so I think that steroids can kind of bridge that gap and then make the playing field larger, thus growing the sport of disc golf. But and then once you get to a certain point, you could limit it.
But if I took steroids, I would be able to throw 700 feet.
Yeah, but at that point, the benefit of throwing 700 feet to 500 feet isn't nearly as big as throwing 500 feet to 300 feet.
Well, I also don't think, personally, I don't think
no one on tour right now is throwing 300
feet. That's what he's saying. He's saying someone who can't break 300 feet could take steroids to get to 500 feet. But I don't think that's true. I personally don't think strength.
No.
Because the farthest throwers in the world probably have...
Most people,
like,
yeah.
If you take Ezra, probably the most muscle mass on the disc golf pro tour, he doesn't throw as far as Eagle, who has one of the lower muscle masses. Nothing against either of those players. Yeah. I think it's more so the flexibility and technique, which, I mean, I don't know if there's a performance-enhancing drug that makes you like a rubber band, but that's what you need.
That would be incredible.
Yeah, just something that you just take and out of nowhere.
Yeah,
just,
I don't think it's, you know, obviously like in baseball and stuff, there is, the baseball swing is very similar to, you know, a lot of people put those two motions together, baseball swing and a disc golf throw. But the disc golf throw is much more form oriented in the sense that you actually have to release the disc in a certain way, where the baseball swing is just like literally how fast can you swing the bat. And that's why like steroids in baseball, you have guys like McGuire and Sosa. I mean, I think if you look at Sosa's numbers pre-steroids to post-steroids, it is like insane how many more home runs. I mean, he went from like a 30 home run guy or something like that to an 80 home run guy.
It was like a,
I don't think you're going to see that necessarily in disc golf, where like if you can only throw 300 feet, right? If you're like a 25-year-old dude and you can only throw 300 feet, it's not because you're weak.
Yeah.
I also think the side thing too is
if there was some magical drug that made you immediately be able to throw farther, then anyone who is a professional disc golfer would be stupid not to take it. And then it's the same thing as like, everyone's now everyone has to take it, or you're not balanced. And it's the same thing of like, well, we could just have it where no one takes it and then it's balanced again. It's like in the MLB when they recently were more strict or whatever they did with the pine tar. To where
now that you said that, I actually think it would be bad, because right now in golf, they're trying to make people not be able to hit the ball as far as they can. Like, that's the issue, is like too many people are hitting it too far. So in disc golf, if you make it to where people can throw farther, I mean, think about that. Think about if people can throw 700 feet. How do you make a par four?
You can't really.
See, that's my argument though, and then that comes down to course design, because I think that the benefit of throwing 500 to 300 is so much greater than throwing 700 to 500, because course design,
but now,
if you do a technical par four with like, say, like a late Mando, something like that, that requires two technical shots and then a pitch up for birdie, I say throwing 700 feet isn't as much of a benefit.
But you have to take into account too, if I can throw 700 feet with my driver, that means I can throw 500 feet with my mid.
Yeah.
So now the people that are throwing 500 feet just because of steroids, they're having to throw high speed drivers, have a lot of skip, way harder to control. And now I'm literally just, you see that all the time. Like Paige Pierce, for example, like her main advantage is the fact that she can throw putters just as far as some players can throw drivers. And so when she's off or misses her line or whatever it may be, her shot is nearly not as bad as someone that misses a driver. So I don't know. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue right now is just the fact that our players pool is too small. I think if 5 years from now, if you're like, hey, there still is only 10 guys on tour that can throw 500 feet, sure, let's start, you know, stabbing everyone in the butt with steroids. But I don't see that happening in 5 years. I think in 5 years, you're going to have a multitude of people that can throw 500 feet. And then you're still going to have guys that can only throw 450, but they have gotten to the point of where they have other skills that are better or whatever it may be to be able to compete with the people that can throw five.
Yeah, that was kind of the point of,
yeah,
I guess, me bringing up this topic, was me trying to increase the player pool to where there is more players, to where there is kind of more people who can do some of those crazy things with the disc.
Yeah, I think this year, if you watch it, I think this year you're going to see a lot of people being able to throw far. And, you know, coming when you're watching coverage too, you sometimes are only seeing a small population of players. Mm-hmm. There are tons of guys that never make it onto lead card, chase card, feature cards that throw so far.
Well, I mean, even I've seen guys in MA1 throw over 500 feet consistently, but it's their putting and upshots that are awful. Mm-hmm. To where, like, distance might be what some people think is all that's holding them back, but when you see the... I would almost guarantee that those same people, if you put them on a course with a pro... It's not just distance, because the putting, the accuracy, all of that is just at a whole different level. It just, when someone throws a shot at 250 feet, I think we all have the same syndrome of being like, oh, I could have done that.
Yeah.
There's when it's like, you're not going to be able to do it every time.
There's only right now, there's only a handful of tournaments I've gone to where I'm like, yeah, if you can't throw over 450 feet, you can't win. There's only a handful of tournaments that we've played.
Yeah.
It's definitely the minority, yeah. But... dark horse, you never know. We might be getting butt shots.
Who knows?
There you have it. All right. Thanks for calling in. That was a good one to end on. Everyone that's listening on Twitter Spaces right now, this is a live podcast going on right now on the Foundation Podcast YouTube channel. You can go over, subscribe to that. We go live every Tuesday night, so check in, and we'll be here next week. Twitter Spaces taking more calls. Thank you guys for tuning in on Twitter Spaces.
Boom. There you have it.
That's Twitter Spaces.
I did want to, before we wrap up the show, give a quick shout out that this Friday. I don't have the time. I wish I had the time, but we're not 100% positive on when the live stream for the Disc Golf Network is going to happen.
Are we doing it?
We're doing it. Whenever the Disc Golf Network on Friday is the skills competition, we'll be doing a companion stream from our new live stream studio in our new office space. That's actually our old office space redone. Interesting. We'll be doing a live stream, companion stream. We'll probably have some like side bets. We'll put some blizzards on the line, stuff like that, so it can be a little bit more entertaining. And we'll also be live tweeting during it as well. So if that's something that you want to watch, you know, obviously you'll have to be subscribed to the Disc Golf Network to be able to actually watch the live stream, but you'll be able to watch a camera of us reacting to the live stream and just hang out with us in the chat. We'll have some pizza that you won't be able to eat, but we will. And it'll be a good time. That'll be happening Friday. We'll post more details as soon as we know the exact times and stuff like that of when we'll be live and for all that. But All-Star Weekend coming up this weekend.
Heck yeah.
Going to be a good time. Also, there's some football game on Sunday, but no one's going to watch that because the All-Star Weekend will still be going on.
It's the big game.
So there you have it. That wraps it up. Brody, you should still do...
I did pretty good.
I felt like it was a good show.
What do you think?
What?
First show for Hunter?
Pretty well, good. He's been, yeah.
It's almost like I've he's planned been doing like this. 200 podcasts before.
He's been doing this for a long time.
It was pretty solid.
Yeah.
It was pretty solid.
Yeah, it was great. Hey, congrats, Hunter.
Thanks, man.
There's nothing else.
I give you my seal of approval.
Perfect. You want to still do your call out or you want the show just.
No, you know, I think people are starting to finally realize that we want people to call in that disagree with us. I think that last caller was kind of a dark horse move where it's like whatever stance
whatever you
take,
say, I'm taking
I'm
the
going
opposite.
The opposite.
I will say I did notice some people in the Twitter spaces that have requested, but they weren't raising their hand, that either have me blocked or have threatened to block me multiple times.
Dang, why didn't you tell me that?
Because they weren't raising their hand. I just saw their name pop up in the chat and I was like, hey, we're finally getting the people who like we started this show for.
Yeah, we started the show for people to come on and give their opinions on why they think we are idiots. But yeah,
and
thanks
they might
so much.
Be right.
Thanks so much for you guys watching. We'll see you next week. Just be on the lookout what time it will be.
Yeah,
it won't be 5
different
o'clock.
Time, but.
But thanks for tuning in. Like, subscribe, do all that fun stuff. Y'all, take care.